Hello, this is Sandra Ferguson with the Friday, December 8th, 2017 edition of the News Gazette. And we'll begin on the front page with an article from the 15th District Representative called Shimkus Expects Fast Action on Tax Bill by Deborah Pressey, Washington. U.S. Representative John Shimkus looks for work on a tax cut bill to wrap up in a matter of weeks, he said Thursday. Shimkus, Republican from Collinsville, is one of the 9 House Republicans appointed to a conference committee to negotiate details of the tax overhaul. The conference committee hasn't formally met yet, he said, but his guess is there's going to be a tax bill completed and signed by President Trump by Christmas. I think we're moving quickly, he said. Shimkus says he's wanted to see tax reform throughout his legislative career, and looking back 2 decades, he didn't ever think that reform would ever be this close. A big benefit for wage earners would be simplicity in tax filing, according to Shimkus. Some 80% of his constituents don't itemize their deductions now, and doubling the standard deduction would raise that rate to 90%, he said. When you say 90% of people who filed can file on a postcard, that's very compelling, he said. Shimkus contended that the public wants a tax code that is simpler for them and one that is transparent. He understands there's a lot of support in university communities for keeping tax deductions for student loan interest and tuition waivers for graduate students, he said. However, he also said, when you provide tax breaks and incentives, someone is paying for them. Shimkus continued to express support for ending the federal estate tax, also known as the death tax, a measure he said the agricultural community wants, especially in rural America, the accumulation of property over decades, a family-owned farm. Under both House and Senate bills, the estate tax exclusion amount would be doubled. Shimkus further said he believes an end to state and local tax deductions will remain a part of the overhaul, despite Illinois' higher taxes. The rest of America is subsidizing the poor fiscal management of high-tax states, he contended. The state of Illinois should lower their taxes, Shimkus said. Richard Kaplan, the Guy Raymond Jones Chair in Law at the University of Illinois, said a signed tax bill by Christmas is a reasonable time frame, considering the accelerated schedule that has gotten it to this point. A slower pace would open more opportunities for people to mobilize against proposed changes, he said. The faster the better, if you're interested in getting the legislation enacted, Kaplan said. He doesn't see this as a major tax overhaul, but more a tweaking of certain provisions, he said. It's likely going to affect how many people itemize their deductions, Kaplan said. But he also pointed out 2 biggest tax leakages, exemptions for employer health insurance and 401k contributions were left untouched, while some other employer fringe benefits, among them moving expenses, employer-provided housing, and employee achievement awards, would become taxable. With most people already taking the standard deduction, they won't likely see a significant change in how they do their taxes, Kaplan predicted. They didn't itemize before, and they won't itemize now, he said. Meanwhile, dropping the top corporate tax rate from 35% to 20% would be a huge change, he said. Most businesses would see tax cuts. And the next piece is from the county nursing home called Christmas Forest Decorates Facility, Thanks to Donors, by Natalie Wickman, Urbana. Why have one Christmas tree when you could have a whole forest? That's the thinking behind holiday decor at Champaign County Nursing Home this year. But it wouldn't be a reality for the cash-strapped facility without help from local businesses. Alicia McCoy, the nursing home's community relations director, said the building has 7 trees and more expected to come today and Saturday. In total, she's expecting 10 or 11 trees to create the enchanted forest. Visitors can't believe how many trees are up this year, she said. I'm hoping it can lift everybody's spirits inside, the staff, residents, and their families. The nursing home has endured its fair share of hardship this year. County voters in April supported the idea of selling the facility, though the Champaign County Board voted in October against seeking bids from private companies interested in buying, an effort to keep it publicly owned. And when the time came for mailing holiday donation ads, the nursing home piqued the interest of several local businesses. The owners of Urbana's Pheasant Ridge Farms gave away 2 9-foot-tall white pines, which are perched outside the facility. "We didn't want any advertising, we just wanted to do it," said August Borchers, the farm's co-owner. "I'd be willing to do it again." McCoy said regulations require real trees to be placed outside, while artificial ones are welcome inside the building, which is where the forest is being assembled. One is sectioned off as a giving tree, placed in the entrance. Residents used ornament tags to write some gifts they'd like to receive, and McCoy said there are only a few tags left. Kay Bronston, an employee of SAC Management Services, that's SAK Management Services, which manages the home, said other businesses that donated trees include Karen's Closet in Champaign, Agewise Care Management in Savoy, Bickford Senior Living in Champaign, and Harbor Light Hospice in Forsyth. One of the nursing home's 142 residents, Jean Barr, said the forest uplifts her. "When I go down, I've got to stay and look," Barr said. "There's something special about a Christmas tree. It's a reminder of our Christ and what he does for us." The completed forest will be shown off this Sunday, McCoy said, during a holiday open house. It will run from 2 to 4 p.m., and she said anyone in the community is welcome. And next, a piece about remembering Pearl Harbor called Honoring the Past, Veterans from Other Wars Honor World War II Brothers by Anthony Zillis. Around 12:30 on Thursday afternoon, Steve Nunn lifted his can of beer for a toast at Champaign VFW Post 5520. It was Pearl Harbor Day, and even though no one in the establishment or at any other VFW or American Legion in Champaign-Urbana at midday Thursday fought in World War II, veterans and children of veterans sitting at those bars still honored it. "It was one of those situations that we were bombed on our home front," the Vietnam War veteran said. "I'm not old enough to have been there, but we all celebrate it every year here." That was a fairly common refrain from the men and women at veterans' establishments around Thursday. A few World War II veterans linger, staying involved well into their 90s. But most of the men that sat at the bars sipping drinks at these mostly dimly lit halls Thursday were veterans of Vietnam, with a few from the Korean War sprinkled in. Those wars don't have a day that matches the gravity of December 7, 1941, which served as a rallying cry for many who would eventually sit at these bars. Most of the veterans from that era have either died or live in nursing homes. Post 5520 bartender Lynn Grimes's father enlisted in the military days after Pearl Harbor as a naval engineer. Her mother's three brothers also enlisted, and two of them returned home alive. "It was a day that he remembered," Grimes said. "I don't think it was as solemn as someone who actually was there." But the World War II veterans and her family are all gone now. Of course, the passage of time long ago began wiping away memories of that infamous day. Storytelling, after all, wasn't always plentiful from those who fought in the war. Few were more tight-lipped than Beverly Wick's father, Ed, who worked as a sports reporter for the former Champaign-Urbana Courier. Wick, who entered the Urbana VFW just before noon Thursday, thought her father was simply a war reporter during World War II. Only when she found paperwork buried in a box from his house after he died did she realize he had fought. Otherwise, his story would have been completely lost to time. I said to my brother, "Are you reading what I read?" Wick said. He said, "It says he won a Bronze Star and a Purple Heart." That was just him. The bulk of the occupied bar stools were filled with veterans of a war with a far different public perception. When they came back from World War II, there were parades, Vietnam veteran Chuck Whitney said. There wasn't one for us. I had eggs thrown at me. Stories, of course, will live on in history books. But the personal significance of December 7, 1941 is already beginning to die. Once, as several veterans described it, the local VFWs and American Legions were run by World War II veterans, both literally and symbolically. The Urbana VFW was created by World War II veterans. Now only one, Jim Kelly, is heavily involved, although he spends part of the year at his home in Florida. As one Vietnam veteran at the Champaign American Legion described it, December 7th of each year was a day that was for World War II veterans. All veterans, though, can relate to the symbolism of that day. It is significant for all veterans. It doesn't make any difference, Whitney said. It's a loss, and we all had losses. All veterans appreciate that. They gave up their lives for us, just like any war. And we'll turn now to the opinions and page and begin with an editorial called New Reality in Middle East. President Trump's decision to recognize Jerusalem as Israel's capital is both a reaffirmation of and a sharp break with longstanding American foreign policy. President Donald Trump, as is his wont, shook up the status quo again Wednesday, this time in the Middle East. After years of presidents paying lip service to the idea of officially recognizing Jerusalem as the capital of Israel, Trump ordered the U.S. State Department to begin the lengthy process of moving its embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem. He described his decision to recognize Jerusalem as that nation's capital as an acknowledgement of reality and a necessary condition for achieving peace. He's right about his first point. Jerusalem is and always has been the capital of Israel. Its Supreme Court, residences of the country's highest officials, and legislature are located there. Foreign diplomats who talk with top Israeli officials hold their meetings there. Congress recognized Jerusalem as Israel's capital in 1995. But Congress included a proviso that allowed Presidents Clinton, Bush, and Obama to invoke a waiver delaying that recognition because of the potential for violence. That's why President Trump's assertion that his decision will boost the peace process is problematic. It might, and it might not. No one knows. If Jerusalem is burning by Saturday, we'll know the region hasn't changed much, former State Department advisor Aaron Miller said. Both Israel and stateless Palestinians claim Jerusalem as their capital, and U.S. refusal to step into the issue was seen by many people as a necessary posture of neutrality in the quest for an elusive peace in the Middle East tinderbox. Now, critics say, the U.S. position of neutrality has been undermined. That's why foreign leaders in France and Great Britain, not to mention the leaders of Middle Eastern countries, took exception to Trump's decision. They all invoked the hallowed peace process, which is mostly a farce. As long as the Palestinian leadership remains committed to the destruction of Israel, achieving a real peace will be impossible. So the issue is not so much about peace in the long term, but the eruption of more violence in the short term. That depends on the state of the Middle East, still a boiling cauldron, but for different reasons. Middle Eastern countries that have supported Palestinians and condemned Israel in the past have new issues with which to deal, including an increasingly aggressive Iran, a destabilized Iraq and Syria, a lawless Libya, and an increasingly nervous and changing Saudi Arabia. Where do the Palestinians fit on the priority lists of those countries facing what they consider to be existential threats from each other? Widespread hostility toward Israel over the years has masked, at least to casual observers, the intense hostility, competition, and fear the countries hold for each other. That reality makes the Middle East the same powder keg it's always been, but for new reasons as well as old. In announcing his decision to recognize Jerusalem, President Trump kept a campaign promise that was embraced both by his supporters and some of his most zealous critics. It also reverses what Harvard Law professor Alan Dershowitz calls a benighted decision to change American policy by engineering the United Nations Security Council resolution declaring Judaism's holiest places in Jerusalem to be occupied territory and a flagrant violation under international law. It was President Obama who changed the status quo and made peace more difficult by handing the Palestinians enormous leverage in future negotiations and disincentivizing them from making a compromised peace, he writes. That's one side of the argument, and there will be many who disagree. But the Middle East always has been more about power than wise policy. President Trump's decision reflects the powerful role the U.S. plays. Future events will determine the wisdom of the policy. And we'll turn now to the From Our Readers section, and we'll begin with a piece written by Stephen Scher of Urbana called Bus Company Ad Was Bigoted. I am confused about why one of the News Gazette headlines writers chose to put the word bigoted in quotes, in scare quotes, over the story reporting on the atrocious ad run by Suburban Express. How else do you interpret the ad's implication that Suburban Express's competitors' buses are like riding a bus in China, and that that is somehow a bad thing? And how else do you interpret their so-called apology that consisted largely of an insult to the many international students who have contributed so much to the University of Illinois and to our community at large? I don't recall ever seeing quotation marks in a headline before, and I hope it doesn't become a habit in your newspaper, which is in quotes, especially when the facts speak so plainly, as they do in this case. And that again was written by Stephen Scher of Urbana. The next piece is written by Larry Bloom of Champaign, and it's called News Gazette, Don't Forget, Merry Christmas. I read the lady's recent letter about the heading on the Thanksgiving Day paper, and for some reason I just missed it that day because the News Gazette just doesn't thrill me much anymore. But I agree with her, and if for some odd reason the News Gazette just happened to miss writing Happy Thanksgiving at the top, as always, I'm sure you'll remember next year. And with Christmas coming up, you'll not forget that holiday, will you? Because I can always forget paying for my subscription, too, like a lot of others out there. You have a nice Christmas season, you hear? And that again was written by Larry Bloom of Champaign. The next piece was written by David Green of Champaign, and it's called Capitalism Has Deadly Past Too. Bruce Kaufman, History Lessons, December 3rd, finding himself aroused from his American exceptionalist complacency by alleged ignorance of history among millennials, states, democracy and capitalism, for all their faults and inequities, have improved and saved far more lives than they have ended. This euphemistic assertion of moral relativism was occasioned by a poll in which the majority of millennials expressed a preference to live in a communist or socialist nation rather than under capitalism. So, how many million massacred/cleansed Indians, enslaved Americans, incinerated Jews, and carpet-bombed and napalmed Asians does it take to make saving lives not okay, at least in hindsight? Such morbid apologetics and finger-wagging condensations are unbecoming, and more so from someone whose hortatory anecdotes are boring and useless to youths who, nearly three decades after the end of communism, are faced with radical inequality, perpetual war, and environmental and social ravages of climate change. Capitalism triumphant, that is, wealth hoarding, austerity enforcing, mass incarcerating, structurally racialized, war making, species destroying capitalism, is the global systemic outcome of five centuries of coercive accumulation and two-plus centuries of liberal/elitist democracy. Pardon millennial realism and idealism if they see capitalism as functioning in contradiction to government of, by, and for the people. Pardon their admirable faith in democracy, however betrayed, to support popular movements for governmental limits on free markets and socialized provision of education and health care, for modest starters. Kaufman shamelessly quotes Ronald Reagan, "If we forget what we did, we won't know who we are." Absurdity gives way to irony, irony to truth. And that again was written by David Green of Champaign. The next piece is written by Amy Clay Moore of Urbana, and it's called "Davis Tax Vote Fails Local Economy." Without a robust university powering our economy, Champaign-Urbana is no longer a destination. It's just another rest stop along Interstate 57. We should be very concerned about how the proposed tax bill will affect our local economy. Specifically, the provision that counts tuition waivers as taxable income. Of the nearly 12,000 graduate students at University of Illinois, almost 7,000 receive tuition waivers. If tuition waivers become taxable income, droves of students will be forced to drop out of their graduate programs to seek employment outside of Champaign-Urbana. Fewer graduate students reduces the need for the number of faculty/staff employed by the university, resulting in layoffs. It will also result in the decline of an affordable yet highly skilled workforce that assists with teaching and undergraduate courses and who drive the university's cutting-edge research, reducing the number of undergraduate students and amount of research funds coming into our university. As students, faculty, staff, and their communities leave our community, they will be vacating homes and apartments, leaving empty seats at our fabulous local restaurants and bars, taking their money out of our banks and business away from local doctors, lawyers, plumbers, mechanics, among others. Where is the stimulus in that? Congressman Rodney Davis expressed concerns about taxing graduate tuition waivers, but voted for a bill that included it anyway. Rodney Davis owes it to our community to demand a tax bill that actually stimulates our economy. How many jobs can we let Congressman Davis cost us before it costs him his job? And that again was written by Amy Clay Moore of Urbana. The next piece is written by Joseph Bowers of Champaign, and it's called "Chief is History, New Topics Please." It is a restful day when the News Gazette letters column does not include mention of Chief Illiniwek. The passion for this topic among grown-ups escapes me. His retirement 10 years ago caused a seismic rumble in what is called Illini Nation, an upheaval that apparently will not die. Why is this? We are talking, after all, about a fictional character. The Illinois Federation, sometimes called the Illiniwek, were a loosely allied group of 12 to 13 tribes that thrived in agriculture and hunting. Their world collided with the Iroquois, who sought conquest of rival tribal lands because their hunting grounds had been depleted, and the invasion of white Europeans, who brought disease and violence. I have read in ad infinitum all the arguments on both sides of Chief Illiniwek's authenticity. There is no new ground to plow there. I do wonder, however, just how much Indian history Chief Zealots know. A good place to start would be Bury My Heart at Wounded Knee, an Indian history of the American West, written, ironically, by a University of Illinois professor named D. Brown, no relation to the noted Illini hoop star. Meanwhile, there is plenty of room for passion in the letters column. How about our tax dollars supporting American hegemony in endless wars, killing untold thousands of innocents around the world? How about government collusion with powerful corporate interests? How about an election system hopelessly corrupted by money? Those ought to be a good start. And that again was written by Joseph Bowers of Champaign. The next piece is written by Jennifer Roth of Urbana, called GOP Listening to Donors on Tax Bill. In a sane world, the process of legislating would include writing a bill, holding hearings, getting input from experts on the bill's impact, and listening to public opinion. Republicans in the Senate took the road less traveled by scribbling major updates to their tax bill in the margins and ramming the whole thing through at 2:30 a.m. Saturday so the Congressional Budget Office and the Joint Committee on Taxation wouldn't have time to analyze it. Why would they go to such lengths to pass a catastrophically unpopular bill? One, a recent Reuters Ipsos poll found that only 29% of Americans support. I'll let them tell you in their own words. My donors are basically saying, get it done or don't ever call me again, Representative Chris Collins, Republican from New York. If the GOP doesn't deliver corporate tax cuts, the financial contributions will stop, Senator Lindsey Graham, Republican, South Carolina. The donor class has concluded that the inaction of this administration and Congress is totally unacceptable. Josh Holmes, former chief of staff to Senator Mitch McConnell, Republican from Kentucky. Still, somebody must be excited about the bill, right? The most excited group out there are big CEOs about our tax plan. Gary Cohn, former COO of Goldman Sachs, current White House National Economic Council Director. Oh, when the House Senate Conference Committee report comes back to the House, Representative Rodney Davis, Republican from Taylorville, will have one more chance to serve his constituents instead of his donors. If he votes yes, we'll know he didn't choose us. And that again was written by Jennifer Roth of Urbana. And we'll take a short break now and then return with the second half hour of the Friday, December 8th, 2017 edition of the News Gazette. I'm Sandra Ferguson. Please stay tuned.